today I'm going to start off with a few final comments on Bell's theorem, and then I'm going to move on to the first of two lectures on contextuality. So I want to start by talking about the extent to which violations of Bell inequalities can act as a resource. So we touched a bit on this in the lecture criticizing the operational approach. So there is something kind of magical about Bell inequality violations. They're useful in a lot of information processing tasks, but because they're very non-intuitive, it always feels like a bit of a trick. And so when I first prepared these slides years ago, I went looking for a definition of magic on the internet that would sort of fit Bell inequality violations. And I'm sad to say that the definition that fit best was from the Harry Potter Wikipedia page. But it fits nicely. It's a natural force that can be used to override the usual laws of nature. And Bell inequality violations are natural phenomena, and they just override the usual classical-like laws of nature. So this is the kind of stuff you can do with Bell inequality violations. I'm not going to go into any detail in these guys. But you know, there's something called communication complexity, which is about how many rounds of communication I need between two parties to evaluate some joint function of their data. Secure key distribution is where two parties want to set up some secret key, which they can later use to do a one-time pad to encipher a message. Randomness expansion is about generating random bits that you know your adversary doesn't have any access to. And and there's something called zero-error channel capacity, which again, Bell inequality violations help you with. So this is just kind of an idea of the sort of range of stuff. But let me give you a couple of clues as to how this sort of thing works, just so you have a feel for it. So the key, in some of the proofs of the security of key distribution protocols, they use this fact called monogamy. So suppose Alice and Bob are the ones who are trying to distribute key, and there's an adversary, so there's Alice. There's Bob, here's the adversary, who wants to find out something about the outcomes of their measurements. So what you can show is that for correlations that violate Bell inequalities, there's a kind of monogamy relationship, that if Alice and Bob have those sorts of correlations, then nobody else can be highly correlated with them either, if you assume that you can't signal faster than the speed of light. So here's how the proof goes. So this is a very simple example. So suppose that Alice and Bob had these perfect correlations for the game we played last time, where these nodes here mean there are two choices of measurement that Alice can make. That's like the heads and tails, they're each binary outcome. Two choices of measurements Bob can make, heads or tails, each binary outcome. And we imagine that when they both get heads, it's their outcomes are correlated. Heads and tails and heads, their outcomes are all correlated. That's what those straight lines mean. But when they both have tails, their outcomes are anti-correlated. So just imagine that they have some bipartite system which allows them to generate those kinds of correlations. We know that in quantum mechanics, the best you can do is 85%, but just imagine that you have 100%. And now the question is, could the adversary have exactly those same correlations with Alice? So the adversary has a system that maybe was prepared together with the pair of systems that Alice and Bob get. Adversary has some third system. Adversary also does two measurements, binary outcome, and hopes to get the same sorts of correlation with Alice's outcomes as Bob does. Because then the adversary could have all the same information Bob does, and sort of, you know, if they're going to generate key based on the outcomes of their measurements, the adversary could generate that key as well. So what I want to convince you of is that this pattern of correlations is not possible if your theory is non-signaling. Okay, so we're assuming that the theory allows these strong violations of Bell inequalities, but remember, violations of Bell inequalities don't imply signaling faster than the speed of light. So just imagine that we have, you know, we're imagining a theory like quantum theory. You can't signal faster than the speed of light, but you can violate Bell inequalities. So you can't have this sort of shared correlations, because if you could, you could use it to send signals, and here's how. Suppose these two particles were brought together so that you could do measurements on both and compare the outcomes, right? That would be possible in this kind of world. Then, based on the correlations between the outcomes of these measurements, you could learn what Alice's setting was. So for example, you could do the head measurement over here on this particle and the tails measurement on this particle, And if you saw that your two outcomes, and if Alice had done the heads measurement, then her outcome would be correlated with both of these outcomes, here and here. And so these outcomes would be correlated with one another. But if Alice had done the tails measurement, then she'd be correlated with this outcome and anti-correlated with this outcome. So these guys would be anti-correlated with one another. So all you'd have to do is look at the outcome of the heads measurement here and the tails measurement there, see if they're correlated or anti-correlated, and you would learn whether Alice had done one measurement or the other, and that could be used to send signals. Okay? So this is just to give you a bit of a flavor of how Bell inequality violations, together with no signaling, imply these interesting constraints that you can't share correlations among many parties. And it's this kind of thing that allows you to build a protocol where Alice and Bob violate a Bell inequality, and they can be certain that as long as the, you know, there's the no signaling principle is respected, no adversary is going to have access to the outcomes of their measurements, or is not going to have perfect information about those outcomes, and so you can do some sort of privacy amplification and get a secure key out of it. Questions about that? Okay, let me give you a second small kind of tidbit about how Bell inequality violations are useful computationally. So many people have talked about perhaps it being Bell inequality violations that power quantum computers. Here I'm going to give you a different example. So it has nothing to do with quantum computers per se. It's still a way that Bell inequality violations can increase the computational power in a particular sense. So there's something called measurement-based computing. And in the quantum context, it's called measurement-based quantum computing. And the idea is that you have a resource of correlation, and then you have this control computer. And the idea is that you put in the classical inputs of your the computation you want to do, you get the classical outputs. And the way your computer works is it does some classical processing, and then it takes some of the bits and it uses them to choose a setting for a measurement on a particle. And then it gets the outcome of that measurement, and then it feeds that forward into the computer. So you're sort of accessing the correlations among the outcomes of these guys for various settings as sort of calls from your computer. And you can show that this model is sufficient, is universal for quantum computation. If this computer up here is just a universal classical computer and you have the right kinds of entangled states in your resource. But you can consider another model where your control computer is extremely weak, meaning it can only do linear gates. So classically, that means it can do NOT gates, and it can do XOR gates, which are just basically, in binary arithmetic, summing modulo 2. But it can't do an AND gate. It can't, you know, do the truth table where for 0, 1, or 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0, it maps to 0, 1, 1, it maps to 1. That would be a nonlinear gate because it would be the product of the two bits that you had. Okay, so it's no nonlinear gates at all. So it's extremely weak as a computer. You can't do anything interesting if you haven't got any AND gates. And so what's been shown is that if you have this weak linear computer and you have access to a correlated resource that violates a Bell inequality, you can promote it from linear to nonlinear. So you can actually implement AND gates. This just means that it's principles of classical physics here and quantum physics there. Here's how it works. So I just imagine the simple computation where I have two bits as input to the algorithm and one bit output, and I just want it to compute the AND of the two inputs. Okay, so my control computer can't do AND. It can do this XOR gate. It can do NOT gates, but it can't do AND. So here's the setup. I take the two input bits, and I make them the settings of two measurement devices on some entangled pair. And then I take the outputs of those guys, A and B, I feed them into the XOR gate, and I make that the output. So if it happened that you had a resource, a kind of correlation here that was of this special variety that we talked about last time, where for the first three choices of settings, you get perfect correlation, 0, 0, or 1, 1 in the outcomes. And for the last case, you get perfect anti-correlation. So again, this doesn't happen in quantum mechanics. In quantum mechanics, we can only get this kind of thing where these guys sum up to 85%. But just for simplicity, imagine we had a theory where you could get exactly these kinds of correlations. Well, it turns out that one way to describe these correlations is just that the XOR of the outputs is the product of the inputs. Because the XOR of the outputs is zero when they're correlated, right? If A and B are both zero or A and B are both one, then this is zero. That's zero when the outputs are correlated. And it's one when the outputs are anti-correlated. That's the case where A is zero, B is one, or A is one and B is zero. And you want the correlation to occur precisely in those cases where X times Y is zero, and the anti-correlation to occur precisely in the case where X times Y is one. So that's what this achieves. It achieves the XOR of the outputs being the product of the inputs in binary arithmetic. So if you have a resource like that, then you, when you feed in X and Y, and you ask, okay, how does A and B depend on X and Y? The answer is that the XOR of A and B is the product. So when I take their XOR and I feed it out, I've got the product of X and Y. And that's what I wanted. I wanted an AND gate acting on the X and Y inputs. So this has promoted a linear computer to a nonlinear computer. So again, this is, you know, not, it doesn't say anything about the power of quantum computing, but it gives you a feel for how these strange resources can be used to increase computational power. Okay, so let's get back, before we get into contextuality, I want to make a reference to what we talked about two lectures ago. So we saw that these theories, where you add an epistemic restriction, involve a number of, you know, they include a number of quantum phenomena, but I argue that this is a very weak kind of non-classicality, because the explanation that's provided in these theories is basically a classical explanation. I have a classical ontology. I have a restriction about what I can know. So strictly speaking, you say, well, in a true classical theory, there would be no restriction on what you know. So you could say it's a kind of non-classicality. It is a difference from had the world been classical, but it's a very mild one, because, you know, you can still imagine that everything has well-defined properties, and I just don't know what they are. So let's call that a weak kind of non-classicality. Whereas, for example, these Bell inequality violations cannot be modeled in that way. We know we can't just think of quantum states as a probability distribution over some physical states, and still preserve, for example, common cause explanations that are consistent with relativity. So these are a much stronger kind of non-classicality, and so it's useful to study these in particular. You expect that, you know, maybe all the advantages for information processing that quantum theory gives us come from strong non-classicality. And that's, roughly speaking, what we do tend to see. So many people have thought, okay, well, let's focus in on Bell inequality violations. That'll teach us where the advantages for information processing are. And I now want to say, you know, why maybe you should be unhappy with just focusing on this, and why we should also focus on contextuality. So let me take you through that. So if you want a notion of strong non-classicality, you know, what desiderata should it satisfy? So you may want it to be something that you can subject to a direct experimental test. So what do I mean by that? I mean, if you're interested in knowing how the world could fail to be classical, but not just how the world could be quantum, but, you know, maybe quantum theory someday will be overtaken by another theory, and we may still want to say for that next theory, in what ways does it deviate from a classical worldview? So it's nice to have a notion of non-classicality that just puts a boundary between what you can explain classically and what you can't, and some parts of quantum mechanics might be, you know, in the non-classical regime, but even if quantum mechanics gets overthrown and replaced by another theory, we could still say what aspects of that new theory are truly non-classical. So what was nice about Bell inequalities was that, you'll remember, we derived these Bell inequalities, and there was no reference made to quantum theory. It just said, look, if you think that particles have, you know, physical states about which you're ignorant, and you describe your ignorance by probability theory, you get some constraints, you know, in a local model. And so now I can go to the lab, I can test whether I violate a Bell inequality, and we've done that. And it says that any correct theory of the world will fail to be locally causal in Bell's sense. even if quantum theory is overthrown, the replacement theory will continue to have to fail to be locally causal. So it's nice that the Bell inequalities allow us to directly test them, so we don't have to appeal to any of the formalism of quantum mechanics, any quantum concepts. We can just directly test them and say, yes, what we've seen here resists classical explanations, so this kind of non-classicality is going to have to exist in any future theory. In fact, I would say that's one of the very powerful things about experiments in quantum foundations is that, unlike experiments in many other fields of physics, they tend to have this form that the conclusions you get should apply to any future physical theory. We cannot have an explanation of what we've seen that satisfies these principles. And that means all future physical theories are going to have to give up on one of these principles. So whatever notion of non-classicality you have, it's nice if you can formulate it in a way that it can make direct predictions about the outcomes of experiments without any reference to the formalism of quantum theory. It's nice also if it constitutes a resource. So as I mentioned on the last slide, Bell inequality violations have this feature that when you have that kind of non-classicality, you can also use it for something. So that is a very pragmatic approach to saying that you have something different from a classical world because you prove that you can pragmatically do something that you couldn't have done in a classical world. It's very persuasive that you've really got something non-classical. And then the final desideratum is that ideally you don't want your notion of non-classicality to apply only in very restricted regimes. So in fact, I would say in quantum theory today, we have a kind of diversity of notions of non-classicality that people in different fields prefer. So people working in quantum optics like to talk about whether the Wigner function goes negative. People working on path integrals like to talk about whether most of the amplitude is centered around some action extremizing path. Other people like to talk about decoherence. You have all these various different notions of non-classicality. But really what you would like is a notion that was kind of universal and said it doesn't matter what you're thinking about, whether it's photons or atoms or strings or fields or whatever, here's what it means to resist classical explanation. So yeah, that's the final thing that ideally you would like. And this business of violating a Bell inequality, so failing to admit a locally causal model in Bell sense, satisfies the first two desiderata. So we just talked about how it's a resource. You can definitely test it directly, but here's where it really kind of fails. Because if you look at the setup, I need to do two measurements at space-like separation. And if I think of all the types of experiments you might do in physics, almost none of them fit that description, right? So if I go to the lab and I prepare a condensed matter system and I do some measurements of its properties, there's no space-like separation between anything. So the analysis of Bell's theorem is just not applicable. And so most experiments in physics, would resist the question, does it violate a Bell inequality or not? Because you're just not in the right sort of configuration. So what's nice about this notion of non-contextuality, which I haven't defined yet, but I will, is that it is broadly applicable. So it's a notion of the failure of non-contextuality is going to be a notion of non-classicality that applies even if your experiment looks like this. I prepare some system, maybe I do some transformations on it, and then I measure it. And pretty much every experiment you can think of fits that mold, right? Because that's, I have to prepare some systems and ultimately I have to learn something about them. The Bell experiment fits that mold. I prepare a pair of systems and I do a measurement on each one of them. But there's nothing here requiring there to be composite systems that are space-like separated. So that's why it can really improve over Bell inequality violations as a notion of non-classicality, because you can really apply it to anything. And then the question becomes, but does it satisfy the other desiderata? And it turns out it does. So I'm going to say a little bit at the next lecture about how it constitutes a resource. And I'm also going to partially answer the question about how do you subject it to a direct experimental test. Today, we're not going to talk that much about this. We're more going to start with some of the older approaches to contextuality that didn't really achieve this. And then tomorrow, we're going to move on to the more recent approaches. OK. So as I say, let's go back to back in time to the original notion of a non-contextual model of quantum theory. So this is not something that's going to apply to arbitrary experiments or arbitrary theories. It's really particular to quantum theory. It's asking more of an interpretational question. Is there a hidden variable model of quantum theory that has certain properties? So this is the kind of hidden variable model people were interested in. So this is just an ontological model, which is psi incomplete. I'm adding more than just the quantum state to the model. So if I just focus in on pure states and projective measurements like this one, in a, say in a 3D Hilbert space, the idea is, you know, this is kind of familiar from what we've seen before. I associate that pure state with some distribution over the ontic states. And I associate the measurement with just revealing some property of the ontic states. So it partitions the ontic states based into some regions and says, you know, if I'm over here in this region, then that corresponds to getting outcome psi 1. If I'm in this region, then I get outcome psi 2. And if I'm here, I get outcome psi 3. So these chi's are response functions. They just tell me the probability of getting outcome 1 given that the state was lambda. So if the ontic state is here at this value of lambda, then I definitely get the one outcome and I don't get the others. So notice that in this notion, the reason I am calling them outcome deterministic is that it's presumed that the outcomes of these measurements are fixed deterministically by the ontic state. Once you tell me the values of the hidden variables, there's no uncertainty about what the outcome of the measurement will be. And then, of course, if this hidden variable model is going to reproduce the predictions of quantum theory, then the probability of each of these outcomes, which is just this overlap, has to be given by the probability of getting outcome k, given that the ontic state was lambda, times just the probability that the ontic state was lambda, this mu of lambda, integrated over all lambda. So the traditional notion of non-contextuality, first of all, it only makes sense for three-dimensional Hilbert spaces and larger, and we'll see why. And what it talks about is the situation where you have one of these measurement outcomes, like this vector psi 1, that can appear in many different measurements. So I can think of psi 1 as part of the basis psi 1, psi 2, psi 3, but it also appears in other bases, like psi 1, psi 2 prime, psi 3 prime, where these guys have been rotated in that plane relative to psi 2 and psi 3. One thing you'll notice about this, one thing that quantum mechanics predicts, is that the probability of getting outcome 1 in these two measurements is exactly the same for all preparations you might do, right? So if I prepare psi and ask what's the probability of getting the one outcome here, it's just the overlap of psi with psi 1 mod squared. If I ask what's the probability of getting outcome 1 here, it's exactly the same. So I always see exactly the same probability for getting that outcome in those two measurements. And the idea of a traditional non-contextual model is that that's because I represent those two vectors by the same response function, regardless of which measurement it's a part of. So the idea is that that first outcome of each of these measurements is revealing exactly the same properties. It's saying, is the ontic state in this region or not? The differences between these two things are differences in how I might carve up the rest of the ontic state space, but the first outcome is always just revealing exactly the same thing about the quantum state. Okay. So is that clear? Good? So I'm going to go through a few different ways of describing the same assumption, because if you read about it, there's all these different ways of casting it, and it's useful to sort of see that they're all equivalent and be able to translate easily between them. So let me just put the definition up. The traditional notion of non-contextuality is that every vector is associated with the same response function in your ontological model, regardless of how that vector is measured. So regardless of the context, you know, so is it in this context of this basis or this context? Doesn't matter. Okay, so take two, traditional notion of non-contextuality, take two, it's just an equivalent way of formulating the same assumption. So what people often do is they don't represent the measurements the way we did here in terms of response functions. They just say, imagine a particular ontic state, like maybe the one where lambda takes this value here. So I'm just looking at this slice, or I'm just looking maybe at this slice, and say, what values do I assign, what probability do I assign to getting outcomes 1, 2, and 3 at that ontic state? So So one way to describe it is to say, oh, here are the probabilities of getting each of those values at that ontic state. It's, you know, 1, 0, 0 for the slice I was talking about. I'm definitely going to get this outcome, and I'm not going to get either of these outcomes. That's just, yeah, say here. And then the idea is that, well, if I take that same ontic state and I ask, what are the probabilities of getting each of these outcomes? Because I assign probability 1 to this vector in this context, I have to assign it probability 1 here as well. That's just another way of saying that, you know, for any ontic state, say any ontic state in this region that assigns probability 1 to the first outcome, well, it's got to assign probability 1 to the first outcome in this measurement as well. That's just another way of saying exactly the same thing. And if, for example, I assign probability 0 to the first outcome in this measurement, then I have to assign a probability 0 in this measurement as well. Of course, I can assign, you know, I have to assign probability 1 to one of the three outcomes because some outcome will always occur in the measurement. And because these are different measurements, you know, psi 2 and psi 2 prime are not the same. Here, the one can go in either of these two places. Important thing is that this guy gets the same value. So for every ontic state, every basis of vectors receives a 0, 1 valuation, so an assignment of a single 1. And the others get zeros, or exactly when element is assigned the value 1. And every vector is assigned the same value regardless of which basis it's considered a part of. OK? So you might have heard of the Cochin-Specker theorem. This is Cochin and Specker in the 60s when they came up with the theorem. Turns out Bell also proved the same theorem, so it's sometimes referred to as the Bell-Cochin-Specker theorem. Basically said, this notion we just defined, a traditional non-contextual hidden variable model, does not exist for quantum theory as long as the Hilbert space has dimension 3 or greater. Okay, so this attempt to try to model quantum measurements can't work. This was the original proof of Cochin and Specker. It involved 117 different rays in a three-dimensional Hilbert space, and I'm not going to take you through it because we have much simpler proofs now. But it's kind of pretty, so I thought I would show it to you. Here's a proof I quite like. It involves only 18 rays, and it works in a four-dimensional Hilbert space. So each of the nodes in this diagram represents a ray in Hilbert space. I have written what its components are. It's a four-dimensional vector space, remember? I haven't normalized these guys, so this guy should have a 1 over root 2 in front of it and so forth. But you can verify that for every quadruple of nodes that I've put a loop around, that forms an orthogonal basis. So like if I look at the top four vectors, that's all pairwise orthogonal. And you know, for these four, you can also verify they're all pairwise orthogonal. And so I have six quadruples along the outer edge of the hexagon. And I also have some quadruples that go through the middle. So these four, and these four. So I have 18 rays that are organized into 9 bases of 4 rays each. It's a four-dimensional Hilbert space, so the bases have 4 rays in them. OK, so a traditional non-contextual hidden variable model would say I should assign to every basis, I should assign a 1 to one of the outcomes and a 0 to the other 3. Because that's going to tell me if I were to measure that basis and the ontic state of the system was lambda, it would tell me which outcome I would get, the one that has the value 1. So the question becomes, is it possible to add values 1 and 0 to these nodes in such a way that every one of these quadruples gets exactly a single 1 and 3 zeros? Now remember, the critical thing here is that I'm not allowing the assignment, the assignment to a particular ray to depend on whether I'm considering it part of this basis or that basis. If I was allowed to say, oh, it's 1 when you measure it with this basis, but it's 0 when you measure it with this basis, then the problem would be easy. But the assumption of non-contextuality says no, it has to get a single value, the same value, regardless of what basis it's measured as part of. So if you say, use the color black to denote that it's value 1 and white to denote it's value 0, and you start going, you say, OK, let me make this 1 and these guys 0. That means these guys are 0. Then over here, you can say, well, let me try making this guy 1. That's fine. and the rest of these guys have to be zero. This quadruple has to get a one somewhere. Let's put it here. Eventually you run into a contradiction. So I put in some ones, and now look at this dot. Because it's part of this basis, and I've already got a one, it should be a zero, but it's also part of this basis here, and I have three zeros, so it's gotta be a one. So I can't complete this coloring. And so you can actually, you know, go through all the possibilities. You find none of them works. Here's a proof that nothing will work. Suppose you just take, you just list all four rays in each of these nine bases. Okay, so I've listed all the four from the first slide. And that means because every ray appears in exactly two bases, this guy appears in him and him, this guy appears in this and this. It's true for all of them. They appear in exactly two bases. That means every one of these rays will appear twice somewhere here, right? They appear on two lists of bases. Okay, now in each of these nine quadruples, exactly one ray is assigned the value one and the other three are assigned value zero. So that means that exactly nine rays must be assigned value one. But every ray appears twice on this list, and I have to assign the same value to it regardless of which quadruple it's considered part of. And that means that I should be assigning an even number of ones. And now I have a contradiction. So you know it can't be done. There's no way of assigning ones and zeros to these rays non-contextually. Did I go through that slowly enough so that everyone got it? Clear? Or... Good. Here's another pretty picture. I like this as a kind of visual representation of what's going on in a contextuality proof. If you look locally at any region of this picture, there'll be nothing strange going on. Everything looks fine. It's only globally that you get an inconsistency. And it's the same thing with these sorts of proofs, that I can assign values locally that satisfy all the constraints, but I can't do it in a way that globally satisfies all the constraints. And then here's just a nice little fact that everybody working in contextuality likes to point out, that these little shapes that Escher put on top of these towers happen to include vectors that appear in three-dimensional real Hilbert spaces that constitute proofs of contextuality. So Perez has a proof that involves a number of vectors drawn from this shape, like the vertices of this shape. And more recently, there's a proof that involves 13 rays that pick out points in this shape. So anyways, just a fun coincidence. Okay, let me move on to another way of rephrasing exactly the same notion, the traditional notion of non-contextuality, take three. And it has to do with projectors. So far we've just been talking about rays in Hilbert space. But if I consider a general projective measurement, it can have rank two projectors in it. It can have rank three projectors in it. They don't all have to be one dimensional. So what does non-contextuality imply for the representation of projectors? Well, the idea is that if I have, say, a rank two projector, let me go back to one of my pictures before the old definitions. Where are we? Good. Yeah, like say I took the rank two projector onto the subspace orthogonal to psi one. Well, if my assignment to the rays was such that one of the rays in that subspace got the value one, meaning I'm definitely going to get the psi two outcome. And if I imagine the measurement that just coarse grains the psi 2 and psi 3 outcomes together and just asks, is it psi 1 or is it identity minus the projector onto psi 1? Of course, that measurement's going to say it's the outcome corresponding to identity minus psi 1. Because I know that had I done the fine grain measurement, I would have gotten psi 2. So one way to do the psi 1 versus not psi 1 measurement is just do the fine grain measurement and then coarse grain over two of the outcomes. And so if I'm assigning a definite value to one of the rays, then I have to assign the same value to the rank two projector. And similarly, if I'm assigning zero to all the rays in some subspace, then I would assign value zero to the projector because I'm not going to get that projector in a measurement on that ontic state. So clearly, I should just assign values zero or one to each projector. And what I just said was that, coarse graining of a measurement implies a coarse graining of the value. So if I have a projector, which is a sum of a number of other projectors, if you tell me the values assigned to each of these guys, Well, the value onto the coarse grain projector is just the sum of those values. So if any one of these values is one, then the overall projector will receive value one. If they're all zero, the overall projector will receive value zero. And of course, the projector, which corresponds to the whole Hilbert space, the identity operator, that corresponds to the coarse graining of all the outcomes, where you're just saying, did some outcome occur? You know, and the answer is always yes, one of the outcomes occurred. So that projector always receives the value one because it just says that some outcome always occurs. It's normalization of probability. So instead of assigning values to these rays, you can just assign values to projectors. That's an equivalent way of describing what this hidden variable model implies. And of course, orthogonal projectors, if one projector is assigned value one, the others have to be assigned value zero. Okay, so now we can finally build up to the fourth and final way of expressing this assumption, which involves value assignments to Hermitian operators. This is kind of the old school way of talking about measurements in quantum theory. So suppose you have Hermitian operators A, B, C, and A can be measured jointly with B, they commute, and it can be measured jointly with C, because they commute, but B and C can't be measured jointly with one another. So that's a situation where you have a choice of context. I can measure A with B, or I can measure it together with C, but I can't measure it together with both, so I have to make a choice. And then non-contextuality says the value you get, that your ontological model assigns to the Hermitian operator, should be the same regardless of whether you measure it together with B or whether you measure it together with C. That's the idea. Okay, and it follows from the definitions we've given previously. So when I talk about measuring a Hermitian operator A, you know, what I really mean, the definition of that is I'm measuring the projector valued measure defined by the spectral resolution of A. So in fact, the eigenvalues of A are really just a conventional choice of how to label the different outcomes of a projector-valued measure. So the really fundamental thing for determining the probabilities of outcomes in the measurement is the set of projectors. And then, you know, I can just label each of the outcomes any way I like, and my Hermitian operator is just the sum of those projectors with those eigenvalues. So if you tell me I have a non-contextual value assignment to the projectors, right? So for example, for this set of projectors, I tell you which one of them receives value one and which ones receive the value zero. Okay? That tells me which outcome I'm going to get. Then it's clear, you know, what eigenvalue of the operator capital A you would get if you measured it. It's just the eigenvalue associated with the projector to which you're assigning value one. Because the eigenvalue is just a way of kind of labeling the different outcomes of the measurement. And so that means that if I just write the value of the Hermitian operator to be the sum over little a of the values of pi a, then this will be, you know, all terms will be zero except for one term, and I'll just get the eigenvalue that I'm interested in. So so I can connect the values of the Hermitian operators to the values of these projectors through this equation. And now if you measure A together with B, what you're really doing is measuring the set of projectors onto the joint eigenspaces of those two commuting operators. I'll call those pi sub little a, little b. Little a and little b label the eigenvalues of each of those guys. when you're measuring A alone, what you really mean, like if I say I have a measurement of A, I've implemented by, you know, the fine-grained measurement which measures A together with B, then it really means I've measured the projections onto the joint eigenspaces, and then just ignored what the B outcome was. I didn't care about that one. And so I get back these pi A projectors by just summing over the outcome of the B measurement. Whereas if I measure A in the context of C, then I'm measuring on the joint eigenspaces of those two Hermitian operators and then summing over C. So I can get this one and the same projector here by, you know, like let's say it's a projector onto a rank two space. Well, maybe the joint eigenstates with B look like this, and the joint eigenstates with C look like that, and I get back the projector onto that 2D space by just summing the pairs of projectors in each case. So The point is that if you tell me, by virtue of the old definition, that the value assigned to pi sub a should be independent of context, so independent of whether it's a coarse graining of these projectors or whether it's a coarse graining of these projectors, that's what the previous definition said, is it doesn't matter what it's a coarse graining of, it gets the same value. Well, then it follows then the value I assign to A will be independent of whether I'm measuring it with B or with C, because ultimately, when I measure it together with B, I'm just doing a coarse graining of these projectors, and when I measure it together with C, I'm just doing a coarse graining of these other projectors. So it's just a different language for expressing exactly the same assumption, but it can be a convenient language, because often, you know, talking about Hermitian operators gives a little bit more insight into what's going on in the problem, rather than talking about projectors and rays all the time. So let me give you an example of a nice proof that involves talking about the Hermitian operators. So first of all, notice that if I have a bunch of Hermitian operators, L, M, N, and they all commute with one another, okay? And I know that they satisfy some functional relationship. So, you know, they're all jointly diagonalizable, so ultimately I can evaluate this function by just evaluating how it acts on their eigenvalues. It follows then that whatever values some ontic state assigns to all these operators, those values have to satisfy exactly the same functional relationship. And the reason is, if I ask what set of eigenvalues of L, M, and N could co-occur in a joint measurement of those operators, the answer is only those eigenvalues that you get from some joint eigenstate of L and M and N. So if I take all the joint eigenstates of these operators and act this operator on that joint eigenstate, I'll get this expression here. So if I just act this formula on a joint eigenstate, I get this expression for the eigenvalues, and the joint values that I could see for these guys are just the possible sets of eigenvalues that I could see coming out of some joint eigenstate. Is that clear? Incidentally, I'm happy to stop and re-explain something, so don't be shy if the explanation doesn't come across. I interpret your silence as it is clear, but the only people who suffer if it's not clear are you. So, all right, so that's what I just said. Good. So here's an example of a proof of the failure of this traditional notion of non-contextuality in terms of Hermitian operators. So this is called Merman's magic square, sometimes also called the Perez-Merman proof. And the idea is this: you have two qubits, and the observables we're going to consider are just built out of poly operators. So over here, this is just the poly X operator on the first qubit and identity on the second qubit. You're not measuring anything non-trivial on the second. This is measuring poly X on the second qubit, and this is the tensor product of poly X on the first and poly X on the second. Those three Hermitian operators commute with one another, so I can measure them jointly. And when I do measure them jointly, whatever eigenvalues I get for each of these, the products of those eigenvalues are always one. Another way of saying that is that if I take the product of these three observables in the first row, their product is identity. And that means the product of their joint eigenvalues has to be the eigenvalue of identity, and the identity only has one eigenvalue, which is one. Okay, if you look at all the rows and all the columns of this construction, you'll find they always correspond to commuting triples. So the second row is pretty straightforward. That's also a commuting triple of operators. The first column, clearly a commuting triple, the second column as well. And these are the only non-trivial ones, but you can verify pretty easily that although X and Y don't commute, you have an X2 and a Y2, and so when you work out the commutator of X1 tensor X2 and Y1 tensor Y2, you find that they do commute. All of these guys commute. The one interesting thing is that if I look at the product of the Hermitian operators in this third column here, I get negative identity. whereas all the others, rows and columns, just the products give me identity. So if we take that fourth version of the traditional notion of non-contextuality, it says, look, I should assign values to these Hermitian operators. Those values are drawn from the eigenspectra, constrained to be in the eigenspectra of those operators, and they have to satisfy whatever functional relationships the operators satisfy, the commuting sets of operators satisfy. So if I write v of x1 is the value I assign to x1, v of x2 is the value assigned to this guy, well, these three operators satisfy this relation, so their values have to satisfy that relation as well. And here I've just substituted one for the value of identity, because identity only has that single eigenvalue, so I know its value will be one. So I've just used this constraint from the last slide here, that whenever a set of commuting operators satisfies some functional relationship, the values I assign to them should satisfy that same relationship. I've just used it for this functional relation and all the others to get this set of constraints. So a traditional non-contextual invariable model assigns values to every one of these nine observables. It assigns them in a way that it doesn't care whether it's part of a row or part of a column. So if you see, I have v of x1 here, but I also have v of x1 there when I consider it as part of this column. So that's the assumption of non-contextuality. I don't let the value depend on which context it's considered part of. And then just the facts about how I can jointly measure these guys tells me that the values have to multiply together in a particular way across the rows and across the columns. So I get all of these constraints. And then if you look at them, you'll find that the product of the right-hand sides of these six equations is minus one. But the product of all the left-hand sides has to be plus one because every value appears twice somewhere. So each one of these terms is going to be squared when I multiply all these left-hand sides. And so it follows that there isn't any way of assigning. I should say that the eigenvalues of a poly are always plus or minus one. So I would be assigning values plus or minus one to every one of these guys. And if you look at all the 2 to the 9 ways of assigning plus or minus one, none of them will have the feature that, you know, products across the first three rows and products across these guys are plus one, whereas the product in the last column is minus one. And this is just a proof of that fact. Okay, questions about that? Yes?
To me, this assumption of non-contextuality seems extremely natural. Maybe it's because I'm naive and seeing this for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
If I take it that the world must be non-contextual in this way, do I have to conclude that there are no deterministic hidden variable models that could explain the world? And is that the conclusion?
That's right. If you're committed to this notion of non-contextuality, then you might say, well, something else has to give. So many people say perhaps the very idea that the outcomes of measurements are determined by properties of the particles deterministically is wrong. So first note that unlike the Bell case here, there's some option of giving up determinism. We haven't yet seen whether maybe the problem here is with determinism. Maybe if you just give up determinism, you can kind of salvage the spirit of non-contextuality. We'll talk a bit about that.
Yep.
But most people at this stage say, the conclusion is that the very notion that measurements reveal pre-existing properties must be wrong. Okay? So I'm just telling you, that's the standard line here.
Right.
Yeah.
So most people go with, the world must be non-contextual, I want to give up something else.
And, yes.
Yeah, okay, good.
Yeah. I mean, some people, for example, the Bohmians, the people who are proponents of the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, go the other way. They say, no, the outcomes of measurements are fixed by pre-existing properties, and it's contextual. You know, whether I measure this observable one way, you know, on one basis or another basis, does determine what outcome I get, and they think that's fine. So those are the two main ways out. Okay, let me give you one other example. So this is actually, in some sense, the very first example, because in the late 50s, Ernst Becker was already thinking about these sorts of things. And he wrote a nice little paper, which I recommend that you read. It's very cryptic. So I'm going to try to make it less cryptic. So here's the example he had in mind. So I'm going to move away from quantum theory for a moment. And I'm just going to say, suppose you have a theory. It has measurements in it. And it has a notion of joint measurability. So, you know, in quantum theory, we know how to say, we know how to represent the measurements. We know how to say when they're jointly implementable. That's just if the Hermitian operators commute. And I haven't told you what the criterion for joint measurability is going to be in this theory, but let me just stipulate, you know, it has one. And now imagine the following scenario. Suppose that you've got three binary outcome measurements in your theory, and they can be jointly measured in pairs, but they can't, it's not the case that all three of them can be measured jointly at once, but any pair of them can be jointly measured. Okay, so that's what I mean by these arrows between a pair, that they can be jointly measured. But there's no kind of three-way arrow that would say I can measure all three at once. So Specker contemplated this, and then he said, now suppose that in this world we're imagining, whenever you choose some pair to measure, you find that the binary outcomes are anticorrelated. So let me draw that in as the outcomes always disagree. So if you measure this pair together, you get opposite outcomes. If you measure this pair together, you get opposite outcomes. This pair, opposite. So now if you ask, could I find a traditional non-contextual deterministic assignment that achieves this? The answer is no, because I could say, well, perhaps the ontic state makes this outcome green, this outcome red, this outcome green. I have disagreement here and here, but I don't have disagreement there. Because any way of assigning colors to three things will necessarily make some pair of them the same color. So if the outcomes are fixed deterministically by the ontic state and are independent of context, so I'm not allowing, for example, that this to be green if it's measured with M2 and red if it's measured with M1, that's non-contextuality, has to give the same outcome regardless of what it's measured with, then you'd expect that if you had this kind of pattern of joint measurability, then if you were equally likely to choose any pair to measure, the probability you would satisfy this anti-correlation constraint would be at most 2/3, right? It's like the game we played the other day. The probability that you could satisfy all those correlations was at most 3/4. Here, it's at most 2/3. Okay, so question for you. Can you think of whether in quantum theory we could find some observables that would have this pattern of joint measurability? This is a tricky question.
I suspect so, but I have to.
Yeah, your goal is to find three observables. You can't measure all three of them at once, but you can measure any pair of them at once. Or show that it's not possible. Any thoughts? Okay, let me do a straw poll. Who thinks it can be done in quantum theory? And who thinks it can't be done? Okay. In fact, it can't be done. It can't be done.
Is the opposite way around? No. Is the opposite way around?
It can. There is no triple of observables that have this pattern of joint measurability. And here's the reason that. If let's say I have Hermitian operators A, B, and C. So if A and B commute, then they're jointly diagonalizable. If A and C commute, they're also jointly diagonalizable. And B and C commute, they're jointly diagonalizable. Oh, okay. And that means that there's going to be some basis that diagonalizes all three simultaneously. Mm-hmm. If I measure that basis, I'm implementing all three simultaneously. So Specker recognized this, and you know, he said in his paper, this is a kind of complementarity, a kind of restriction on things we can measure jointly that we don't see in quantum theory. In quantum theory, we have examples where we can't measure things jointly, but we have no examples like this, where we have a triple of things, we can only measure the pairs, we can't measure them all three. And Sprenger said, that's really interesting, he thought. He said, why is it that quantum theory doesn't allow this kind of pattern or joint measurability? And in fact, he was still sort of wondering about that. And these days, people have been thinking a lot about this question. So this is not a question about the correlations, but about the actual pattern of joint measurability. So the very first example, this very simple example, it doesn't have a quantum realization because we can't even find triples of measurement that have the right compatibility pattern. But I still think it's kind of the very simplest example of contextuality you can imagine. You know, if I say I had a theory that wasn't quantum theory that had this pattern, then this is really the simplest thing you could imagine happening. But there's no opportunity to try to violate this in quantum mechanics. However, you can extend this idea. So you can say, suppose I have some set of measurements, and I want the same sort of phenomena. I want a frustrated network of correlations. So I'm going to change my graphical notation slightly. Suppose these nodes now represent measurements, like we had over here, and these edges represent both joint measurability and whether you see perfect or correlation or perfect anti-correlation. So the like before, the straight ones mean correlation, the dashed ones mean anti-correlation. So the one we just saw is the case where I have anti-correlation across all three. But these are also frustrated networks. I can't have these guys agreeing, but these guys disagreeing. And similarly for these guys. Basically, I can't have an odd number of anti-correlations among the nodes, neither one nor three. But they're effectively the same pattern, because if I came up to the first one here and I did something trivial, I just said, let me relabel the outcome of this measurement, say it was originally plus one and minus one, and just flip them and say what used to be called plus one is now called minus one. Suddenly, this guy correlates with his two neighbors, and I get this pattern. So they're really all the same thing under relabelings of the outcomes of the measurements. And when I go to four measurements, I can have a pattern of joint measurability where they're measurable in pairs, but for example, this guy and this guy are not jointly measurable, this guy and this guy are not jointly measurable. And again, I can get frustrated networks like this one where I have agreement on three edges and disagreement on the last one. Obviously, there's no set of values that'll satisfy that, because if it agrees across here, then these two should be the same value. But again, I can do permutations on the outcomes and make other patterns of incompatibility. And here, the idea is that I cannot have every odd number of anti-correlations among the four guys also gives me a frustrated network. So you can build up lots of frustrated networks, and for every one of them, you can get this kind of result that says there's a limit on how well you can hope to achieve that pattern of correlations if you have a traditional non-contextual model of those measurement outcomes. So for instance, in this case, the square, I can say, oh, let's ask for agreement on three and disagreement across one of them. And if I just redraw that on the page by swapping the bottom two guys like this, you'll recognize it as the kind of thing that we saw, where in the Bell context, these measurements are measurements on a pair of particles. So, the two on the left would be something like, sigma z tensor identity, sorry, z poly tensor identity, x poly tensor identity. And then over here, I'd have identity tensor poly in the x plus z direction, identity tensor poly in the x minus z direction. So they're two qubit measurements, but of course, they are jointly measurable when they're on the different qubits. So, anything tensor identity is jointly measurable with identity tensor something. Pattern that we saw in the Bell experiment is an example of this. And of course, as we saw before, if you're going to fix those outcomes deterministically and independently of the context, right? So in the Bell experiment, it was because the context, what you're measuring it, well, in this case, sorry, the context was far away. And so the reason you didn't want context dependence was because you wanted locality. But more generally, you could just say, I don't want this outcome to depend on what it's being measured with. And therefore, I get a three-quarters bound on probability that I'll generate this pattern of correlations. So this is another constraint that comes from traditional non-contextuality for any four measurements, not necessarily ones in the Bell context. And then finally, let me end with this guy. So suppose I take five measurements this frustrated network where they're anti-correlated, that so they can be jointly measured in neighboring pairs, but I failed to have joint measurability across these other pairs. And suppose that it's anti-correlated every time I do a joint measurement. Again, frustrated network, because if this one was plus one, for example, and I go minus one, plus one, minus one, plus one, now I have two pluses, not anti-correlated. So here you expect at most 4/5 of the time you'll satisfy these kinds of correlations in a traditional non-contextual model. And it turns out you can find a set of quantum measurements that have that pattern of joint measurability in a particular quantum state, such that you see the anti-correlations 89% of the time rather than just 80% of the time. So the construction looks like this. Each node corresponds to the measurement in a three-dimensional Hilbert space onto some projector versus the two-dimensional complement. And this projector L1 is orthogonal to L2, and that's why this projector and this projector can be measured jointly. They're orthogonal projectors. And L2 is orthogonal to L3, so they can be measured jointly, L3, L4, L4, L5, L5, L1. So I've actually drawn for you the picture in a real 3D vector space where you can sort of see that L1 and L2 are 90 degrees apart, and similarly with all the other pairs. And then if you prepare this as your quantum state, and you ask, what's the probability that I'll get a 0-1 or a 1-0 outcome, it comes out as 89%. So I get these anti-correlated outcomes. This is due to Kliachko et al. So in tutorial tomorrow, you're going to try to construct more examples of these. Next lecture, we're going to move on to trying to make this a more directly testable notion.